Hello and welcome to the Michigan Writers Series sponsored by the MSU Library. For those of you expecting to see Leonora Smith, I'm not her. My name is Martha and I'm filling in for Leonora. I work at MSU Press. Tonight we have a special treat since Judith Minty is reading her poetry. Ms. Minty has published 9 books of poetry, including Dancing the Fault, Yellow Dog Journal, In the Presence of Mothers, Lake Songs and Other Fears, and the Mad Painter poems, 4 of which are for sale up here, as well as several chapbooks, including Letters to My Daughters and Counting the Losses. Counting the Losses is incredible. It's really, really good, and I urge you to seek it out and find it. Her new book, Walking with the Bear, Selected New Poems, will be published by MSU Press in the spring of 2000, providing we all survive the Y2K transition. Ms. Minty's poems have been called ecofeminist. Judith's poems describe nature in all her wonder and terror, with careful attention paid to her signs and portents. This poetry admonishes us to step carefully upon our mother, the earth. It also traces one woman's relationship with and reaction to nature as she experiences her world organically from a female perspective. Diane Wachowski says that the pure breath of America is in these poems, which celebrate the body in earthy Whitmanian complexities. Ms. Minty's poems are sometimes larger than life in their passion, a passion that celebrates the ordinary and transforms it into the sacred. Judith Minty's poetry details how a woman with a certain sensibility lives in the world. She shows how a woman can be self-sufficient and require solitude as one requires breath, and yet also value connections to family, friends, and community. Her poems honor not just the community of human beings, but the community shared by all: woman, bear, maple tree, mouse. One other thing I'd like to mention is that while some of Judith Minty's poems will make you think, others will make you cry, many will make you laugh out loud. The joy of living runs through these pages. Judith's wit reminds me of Dorothy Parker's assertion that you might as well live. Please join me in welcoming Judith Minty.
Well, thank you, Martha. That was wonderful for not knowing you were going to do this. Wonderful anyway. Thank you. I'm going to move right out here in the front. And so it's a good thing nobody sat in the front row, right? And I'm going to read for about 45 minutes or so. And let's see, what am I going to say here? I thought I'd start with, this is the opening of trout season, for those of you who might not know. And so many people are at the rivers now, well, waiting to see if there's any trout left from last year's takings. My father was an ardent fisherman, so this poem is for him. It's called Meeting My Father at the River. He had an old fishing shack on the Yellow Dog River in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and it's now seems to have fallen into my possession, and I go there often. I didn't used to go with him ever, but then his fishing buddy died of a heart attack, so he didn't have anybody to go with. And it's important that somebody be there because, you know, if you fall in the stream with waders on, you can be in real trouble. And so I was there, and he was out fishing, and I was at this little shack, no electricity, no running water, no telephone, of course, just mice. And he hadn't come back yet. It was getting late. And so I went looking for him. So that's what this poem is about. Meeting My Father at the River. On this evening path from camp to river's bend, shadows roll over and lie down in hollows, then rise from rotting stumps to drift along the lowland. They stalk my boots' dull thud, branches opening, closing overhead. The cabin's lamp, the glowing stove, burn behind me now in memory. At the river, my father still stands in light. This will be his last trip to these waters. His arm lifts, his line wavers, settles over the pool. I have often dreamed this motion, me watching from the bank, him casting, the whir of reel, the bend and dip of rod and arm. Now a small trout rises to the fly. He calls, I got one. It surfaces, flickering in wetness. He is pleased I am here to witness and leans with grace in hip boots for the ritual of netting, stepping shore as a young man again. Good one, I cry and wave. He wades slowly out of sight around the bend, creel bumping at his side. I'm going to read some new poems mixed in with a few old poems. And I thought I'd start with reading a couple of these Michigan poems. This one, it takes place on Lake Michigan where I live now. And I live in a little post office called New Era, but I actually live in the country close to Lake Michigan. And we had a black dog at the time, a black Labrador, so she's in this poem with me. These are from a series where that I've called Degrees of Black and White, just for a working title to get me going to keep writing them. And so when color enters the poem, I hope it takes on added significance. Walking the beach in fog. In this blind world, lost between sunrise and evening, the dog and I follow the shoreline north. No tourists will come here today. The dunes have disappeared, and the horizon, the sky, the driftwood logs and oar boats. We exist in only a circle of light. The dog stays within range of my voice. We don't want to lose each other. Muted without color, we're dots on a fractured piece of landscape where even the water has lost all blue. If we were a painting, we'd be black dog and woman in white, nameless, suspended, viewed by no one, walking nowhere. Ahead and behind swirls another world, and I think of that winter I skied in Switzerland, when we were caught in clouds coming down the mountain, when I was young, when I lost my sense of up and down and thought I was floating. We groped our way then, cautious ghosts traversing the trail. With each turn on the descent, we had to bend low, touch the snow, make sure it was under us. Today, there's just the dog and me. Whatever waits ahead remains unseen. Even these deer tracks fade to nothing. If I walk deeper into this fog, the dog may not follow me. And if she doesn't, what will know me there? Here's another Lake Michigan poem. You know there's islands in the middle of Lake Michigan. So I have to explain when I go away somewhere that it's so big you can't see across it. People don't quite get that. This poem originated from a small, very small article I read in the newspaper that the DNR was looking for someone who had systematically destroyed all the cormorant eggs on one of the islands in the middle of Lake Michigan. For those of you who are interested in marginalia, this poem is all in one sentence. It's called Destroying the Cormorant Eggs. Black, black as the plumage of the double-crested cormorant, all black except for the orange chin pouch below its slender, curved bill, who nests by the shore in shadow and crack of rock, along with the lighter tan or gray or white gulls and terns on Little Gull Island and Gravelly Island in the middle of Lake Michigan. Black as the long shadow of this fisherman or madman slipping over these rocks, these nests, an eclipse, or is it God, something without conscience between sun and earth water, his staff much like a shepherd's crook, but this time carried for balance and for the rest of it. The choosing, knowing which eggs only lovely pale blue, not the gulls and terns brown or buff, then to lift out, to hurl against the granite, to punish them for fishing these waters, to crush under boot or beat with his stick 2,000 eggs, the cormorants now emitting faint squawks, flapping their wings over this darkness, the albumen and yolk, the embryos shining on dull rock, the small pieces of sky fallen down. Black as the night waters of a man's dream, where he gropes below the surface, groaning with the old hungers, the luminescence of his skin now covered by something so thick his arms stroke heavy with it, the water without end, and no island, no island in sight. Well, I just came back from a 2-month trip of following the bird migration. Ended up in British Columbia with the whale migration. This is a poem earlier than this year, but in the same general locale where I start, which is with the sandhill cranes along the Platte River when they're 500,000 sandhill cranes come to the Platte River in March, and they stay for about a month, and it's a pretty amazing thing. So they come from Aransas, Texas, and they're going up to the tundra and up north. But this poem is about snow geese. It's not about the sandhills, who also migrate, as you know, and they stop off in Lincoln, Nebraska, two on their way to the tundra. So I stopped off in Lincoln, Nebraska to see an old friend. And there had been a late snowstorm, and it was pretty cold. And after dinner, she and I walked the neighborhood where she lives. And we encountered the snow geese, called snow geese over Lincoln, Nebraska. All evening they pass and keep on passing overhead, a delirium of voices calling, over this town pressed into prairie, over snow dingy in mounds along curbs and sidewalks, their chatter goes on the wind. I've come from further east, not from this flyway. The ground I've left is still wedded to winter. I'm headed west into rain. I'm not prepared for this stirring, this language of longing, these invisible wings beating north to the tundra. After dinner, my friend and I walk her neighborhood, curved streets, landscaped yards, little ranch houses. We see through picture windows to empty front rooms, lamps lit at sofa ends, but no one sitting there. And we wonder, is all of America asleep? Perhaps the earth has stopped. Perhaps she and I are suspended alone on this street and only the wind and the voices are moving. There's a half moon, stars cluster the sky. It's cold, a blizzard blew through here a week ago. We're wearing coats and gloves, scarves at our throat, and the wind takes our breath when we speak. Yet even through earmuffs we hear them, insistent, demanding, calling back and forth in a frenzy. At the corner, we peer above chimneys and treetops. They circle our heads, but the night's without end. And we're tied to this earth, left gawking, looking up. At last, they light the sky, and their fireflies flickering. No, their snowflakes swirling. No, ghosts trailing shrouds. They're buffeted this way and that. They swirl white. They vanish. We find them again. They're angels singing, sending messages. They're a galaxy, a Milky Way spinning off. They're singing hymns to the earth. They're drifting away. They're leaving us behind. Their song is desire, desire, desire. So let's see. I lived in California for 13 years along the in the Redwood Coast. I lived in a little fishing village, 300 people. There's a woman named Christine who actually doesn't appear in this poem, but she's mentioned in this poem. She's an Austrian woman. She lives in the UP, Upper Peninsula of Michigan, you all know that. And she is a photojournalist, and she was coming to visit me on her way to China for an exchange journalistic thing. So she was going further west than I when she came to visit me. And she and I had been to Prairie Creek, which is where this takes place, where the Roosevelt moose are, Roosevelt elk are. And I had gone there alone now a few weeks after she had gone, or months. Let's see. The hummingbirds are in this poem, too. Lots of birds in, I guess, these poems I selected today. Alone at Prairie Creek. In the meadow, the grasses bend their heads as if in greeting. Dew glistens, and the bench at the edge of these weeping trees is damp. This morning, between prairie and forest, anything is possible. Last fall, in the dry season, I drank from a Coke can on this same bench. A hummingbird, attracted to what I held, came as far as my hand. I was glad for that darting visit, though I'd come for elk browsing in the grass. When my friend Joseph was groundskeeper in a more civilized place, hummingbirds chased the red handles of pliers in his pocket. The year I saw Moira Shearer dance in that film Red Shoes, I fell in love with what was feminine in me. Today I'm alone, and a breeze lifts the alders in commotion. Later, in a dark part of the redwoods, I'll find the lens cap from Christina's camera. She lost it months ago, but things have a way of appearing suddenly. It will be where we stood gaping up at those tallest trees, the tender parts of our necks exposed, where light fell through in shafts as if the gods were looking down, trying to reach us as we prayed. Hawk. Dead hawk outside my bedroom window. Even the cats won't touch it. I laid low for 3 days, didn't leave the house, and wrote my Cherokee friend. He hasn't answered. The hawk's been waiting. Today I took the tail feathers and feet. I feel worst about the feet hanging from the back porch beam, fists clenched, claws like my own hand holding the knife. I knew when the other one flew over Keening, he wouldn't recognize her like that. Let's see. I guess I'll read this one. This is Christina again. Do you remember her, the photojournalist? Well, when she was visiting me, I discovered that I might be what some people call earthquake sensitive, like the cats or the snakes or like worms even are earthquake sensitive. They pop out before it happens, you know. There was a 6.8 on the Richter scale in San Jose. We were in Eureka, but that didn't stop me from being earthquake sensitive because right at the moment, I, who usually buy my clothes in thrift stores, bought a blouse for $140. This is called Christina on Her Way to China, an Earthquake Poem. "Buy that blouse," she whispered, the earth already moving, though we didn't know it yet. We walked over from the car, the blouse expensive, pulling us to the window. We walked rich and daring with that thrust to our hips. The gold beads were electric. She was my friend.
The night before, when I confessed my sins, we'd both wept for what might have been. The dreams that never rose, the lost father of the child in us. Buy it, she said in her throaty Austrian way. She'd just come from snow country to gape at fuchsias, Scotch broom and poppies by the roadside, to Northern California, where everything grows big and wet and lush. She'd come from barren white, a nine-month winter, to trees in leaf and rivers shimmering like snakeskins. I saw bolts of lightning explode from the black silk. I felt something break, a sunburst. I heard a rustle, the crack and fall of timber. Aztec goddesses in temples, said Christina. Will you take a charge card? I asked the saleswoman. The plates were sliding then, the brain exposed, the flash and spark, granite rasping granite. The jolt came then, the earth in motion. Buildings swayed, chimneys fell, the TV talk was rock and grind and rumble. I spun glittering before the mirror and knew we danced the fault. Christina is flying now to China. My earthquake blouse gleams from the open closet. Someone told me once how he'd been standing in a valley, felt the tremble, and watched the fields roll like ocean waves. I thought even then how we are planted here, how ordinary our lives are. How we must make adventure from these briefest shifts and passings.
Well, I think I'll read a prose piece. Ta-da! This is set up there in the same place where the father goes fishing. There's bear up there, you know, along with the trout and the mice. There's at least one wolf I've seen tracks, and moose. So, but the black bear seemed to be happy living in that area. The last one I saw, I thought was a Volkswagen until I got up closer to it. So this poem is... I don't know whether it's prose or a short story or a poem. It's kind of like in between. Don't think about that. It's called Killing the Bear. It takes about 10 minutes to read. And then I'll read some lighter things to finish us off. Finish you off. Killing the Bear. Oh, wait, I should tell you this before I start. It's written in sections, so I'll pause in between the sections. That's how you'll know that there's a new section going to come along. Killing the Bear. She has strung the hammock between two birch trees at the edge of the clearing. Now she drifts in and out of the light there and drowsily studies the pattern made by the rope's weaving and the flickering leaves. When she had the dog, he stretched out beneath the hammock, hackles raised, growling and nipping at flies. He'd meant to save her from shadows. In truth, he startled at noises, even at shifts in the wind, and she ended up more his protector than the other way around. There were wolves at the little zoo when she was a child. She heard them howling from her aunt's kitchen and went to see them up close, and a bear. Three times she visited, slowly circling the bear pen, but he was always sleeping. He looked like a bundle of clothes by the dead tree. His fence was electrified and posted with signs, and she was afraid to touch the iron bars. The wolves set off a chorus of neighborhood dogs. Their calling floated back and forth all that summer vacation. She lies in the hammock every afternoon, her life in the rhythm of the woods, up at dawn to the shrill pitch of blue jays, logs tossed into the stove, match lit, breath steaming in the cabin's chill. Trip to the outhouse, coffee perking, bucket of water from the river. The rest of the morning, ping of nails driven into boards. Her porch is nearly done, one room and another room, something inside and something out.
The afternoon silence and the sway of the hammock lull her, and when she hears a low guttural, she thinks at first it is the dog. Then she remembers the dog is gone. A bear stands beyond the pines, small jets of eyes, heavy black coat. He snuffles, then drops on all fours and weaves into the forest. Her hands lift to cover her breasts. Her favorite doll was a stuffed animal, and she slept with it close to her heart. She was 9 when her mother said, "Give me your bear for 3 months. Let's see if you can stop sucking your thumb." She tried very hard to stop, and when the time was up, she asked for the bear again. Her mother said, "Another month." One day, as she sat in the kitchen watching a cake being stirred and poured into the pan and then put into the oven, it came to her that her bear was gone, that it had been thrown down the incinerator. Only a few years ago, her mother told her, misspeaking even then, "I'm sorry for burning the animal in you." Her hammer has stopped its thump and echo. The roof is laid. The porch smells of fresh paint. She has hauled the old sofa out and can sit there in the evenings if she wants. When the bear understood that she was alone, he came closer. The first time she was reading in the hammock and heard something like a sigh. She knew it was him even before she caught a glimpse of black gliding through the woods. The next time he was so close she smelled him, a terrible, rancid odor. Without looking, she swung out of the hammock and walked to the cabin. 2 days later, he stood next to the birch tree, breath rattling his throat. If she'd turned, she could have touched the bristles on his shoulder. The Gilyak tribe honored him. They put his head on a stake outside their doors and made offerings to it. On Yaetso Island, the Ainus thought he was a man trapped inside the body of a bear. If a hunter found a cub, he brought it to his wife, who suckled it. In Lapland, he was king of beasts. The men lived alone, purifying themselves for 3 days after the hunt. At the funeral, after they had feasted, they put his bones back together in the ground. Once she spent an evening with 2 Swedes. At dinner, their wine glasses held the tint of leaves. Ole, the painter, said, "You live in green light." Gunnar told magic tales. When a woman meets a bear in the woods, she must lift her skirt, then he will let her pass. In the travelogue about Alaska, the Kodiak caught a salmon, his claws stretched out like fingers. When the second bear approached, he reared up. He looked soft and gentle, as if he were greeting a friend, until with a sweep of his paw, he split open the head of the other. In college, a classmate told about the summer he'd worked at Yellowstone and got too close. He never felt the nick, only knew when blood trickled down his forehead. There was also the news story about the woman dragged from her tent in the middle of the night, crying, "He's killing me! Oh God, he's killing me!" The bear carried the woman away, his claws tangled in her hair, ripping at her arm. When she drove to town for supplies, she bought a second-hand rifle. She keeps it loaded now, propped against the door jamb inside the cabin. The clerk at the hardware store showed her how to fire it, how to aim along the sights. He winked and told her she could get a man with it at 20 yards. She said she didn't need a man, just wanted to do some hunting. She misses the dog. She carries the gun awkwardly over her shoulder when she goes to the woodpile or to the river. Her calendar hangs on the cabin wall, each day of summer marked with an X, the rest of the year clean and open. She turns up the wick on the lamp and starts to brush her hair, staring at her reflection in the windowpane. She is thinking about leaving. She is thinking about driving out of the clearing. When the scream begins, it breaks against the walls. It shudders in a moan, then rises. Everything, even the wind, holds its breath. It is over so quickly she almost believes it didn't happen, and raises the brush again and barely recognizes herself in the glass. She runs to the lamp and blows out the flame, then to the window, hoping she will not see what must be there. She did not shoot cleanly the first time. When he ripped the screen and tore the siding loose, she stood on the porch, gun leveled. Go away. He was no more than 10 feet from her when she fired. He spun around and fell to the ground, then raised himself up. When she realized she had only wounded him, she ran into the cabin and turned the lock and leaned against the door. She could hear him thrashing and bellowing in the bushes and against the trees. She knew she would have to step onto the porch again, go to the ripped screen with nothing but night air between them. She would have to take aim and shoot again, and if that didn't stop him, she would have to slip the bolt and reload the rifle and stand there and shoot him again until he stopped bawling and weeping and falling down and getting up and lurching against the trees. When they began this, she never thought she would have to kill him so slow. She never dreamed she would have to hurt him so much. It is nearly dawn when he dies, when she gets up from her chair, when his groans stop pricking her skin. She takes the flashlight and goes out on the porch. She shines the beam around in the gray light and sees the blood dried on the new screen and on the fresh painted sill and spattered on the leaves around the cabin. She sees the trampled bushes and broken branches and where he crawled into the weeds. She shines the arc out, light bouncing on tree and log, until it lands on a black heap huddled in the middle of the clearing. As soon as the sun rises, she begins to dig, and by mid-afternoon, she is through with it. The rope tied to him, the car backed up to the hole, the rifle and box of ammunition remembered and dropped in next to him, the musty soil put back and branches over that. Then she bathes with the last of the water from the river and sweeps the cabin floor, thinking that rain will wash away the blood and that soon enough snow will fall and cover it all. It is dark when she gets to the state line. Next summer, she will dig him up to take the claws. Well, so now I'm going to read these. What will I say about these poems? They're called the Mad Painter poems. That's exactly what they are. So they're like little mini fairy tales. And so, amazing, here you are in a university, you don't have to intellectualize about these. You can just let them flow into you and let them be what they want to be. And I'll just read, maybe I'll read about 7 of these, something like that, and then we'll call it an evening. You can ask me questions, which I'll probably lie about when I answer. No, I wouldn't do that. This is called The Boats Coming and Going. Since morning, many boats have passed our house. We don't know how they get through the narrows, the place where my daughter and I just yesterday stood seining in knee-deep water. Soon the Coast Guard will have to come with sirens and searchlights to tow them off the bar. My friend is angry that I give money to my daughter and get drunk with my husband. She scolds me for being too frivolous and says I should plan for the future. I want to apologize, but I don't know how to console her, don't know how to lift the frown from her face. Years ago, I loved boats. We sailed the Great Lakes to the North Channel of Canada and nearly were lost twice in storms that shredded sails and caused the water to flatten and swirl around us. Believe me, I know what a black line on the horizon can bring. I've seen waterspouts. When the riverboat comes to town, I'll get on it. I'll go in disguise, put on a mask, and wear a hat made of deer antlers. I'll look for a boy in a blonde silky wig and beg him to pose like a Betty Grable pinup. But if the boat heads for open sea, I'll step off onto the bank. If there was some way to make our friends stop weeping, wouldn't we all memorize the formula? I heard once about a tornado that sucked up seashells. When the cloud passed over, you could look up and see conchs, limpets, cowries, black and white speckles, spirals, cones. That must have been the secret of transformation, that ocean roaring in the sky. Oh, let's see. I'm not just going to wander through here. Flying, that was called The Boats Coming and Going, by the way. This one is called Flying People. I first saw them in Canada along the shore at Gore Bay, near those glacially formed prehistoric islands. They were dressed in bright colors, four men and two women, and from a distance they looked like tropical birds. When one zoomed down at me, his yellow shoelaces crackling over my head, I spread eagled onto the dock. I thought they did it by ingesting helium, but that was before I saw the girl, she must have been 12 or so, lift, then falter and get snagged on a barbed wire fence. I had to untangle her wings. Perhaps they were wings. They sprouted from her back and had feathers, but they weren't very mobile. When I finally understood, I went up too. It was wonderfully scary. I soared over the island, then came down near a farmhouse. Then I spiraled up again, nearly sparking the electric wires. The wings aren't so reliable. You have to kick a lot to elevate, then not kick in order to sink. That was called Flying People. This is Raising Pastels. In my grandmother's country, many people raised animals, so I was not unduly surprised when I opened the bathroom cupboard and discovered pastel birds living there. They were about wren size, but pink and powdery blue, pale yellow and a soft minty green. Their down was incredibly soft, and they chirped sweetly. I carefully closed the door. One morning, after I'd opened the cupboard, I happened to look out the window at some crows perched in the pine tree. One had particularly long metallic tail feathers. "What kind?" I called. "Oh, just another crow," it answered, and fluttered down. I'd forgotten to close the cupboard, and before I could blink, it snatched a baby bird. "Rare," it said. "Pink," it said. "Give it back," I cried, weeping. When I grew up, I went to Venice and lived with other expatriates. We all drank too much and sometimes called each other Venusian Venetians. During a boisterous party, one of my friends smashed a honeydew melon in the garden. I was not afraid when pink and green snakes sprang out of it and writhed at my feet, their hooded tongues asking questions in Italian. I thought of my grandmother, how tears had sparkled iridescent on her cheeks when I told her what I'd done. That was called Raising Pastels. Renting out rooms. After I quit my job, I had no choice. Even though I didn't want anyone with children, the first room went to a woman and her son. The boy was as tall as the mother, but he still wore diapers. I've never seen a bigger little boy. I asked if he was 12, but his mother swore he was only 2. I also let a room to an old man with a parrot. We got drunk together on gin one night, and he told me he secretly loves socket wrenches. That's not why I gave him notice, though. It was the parrot. That bird could quote Macbeth, but it also bit my finger and hung on. 2 gay musicians share the back room. They had to hire movers to hoist their grand piano through the window. I call them the Siamese twins. Sometimes I hear them playing duets late at night. Now, though I swore I wouldn't again, a mother and daughter have moved in. The woman kept begging, said she would just bring her sewing machine, that she'd leave most of her things at her aunt's. But their clothes are strewn all over the house, the bathtub is full of toys, and the musicians are complaining. When I knocked on her door to tell her she'd have to leave, she invited me in. "Look," she pointed. Her daughter was napping on one of the twin beds. She wore a white ballerina outfit, a tutu and leotards and little ballet slippers. Everything was spangled and glittery, especially her tiara. She was dancing in her sleep, scooting around on her back. What could I do? I smiled and told the mother I'd never seen anything like it before. That's called renting out rooms. I'll read a few more of these. Oh, yeah, I know which one I want to read. But I'll read this one first. Finding religion. When I was a child, my parents fell under the spell of a guru named Pasha the Holy One. He wore a turban and had a red dot in the middle of his forehead, which he called his third eye and through which he claimed he could see God. During the week, my parents kept prayer beads under their business clothes, but on weekends and holidays, they put on turbans too and took me with them to a purple dome temple in the suburbs. I hated the place, even though it had a fountain with water spouting from angels' mouths. Pasha the Holy One's breath smelled like rotten bananas, and he punished us children for even the slightest infractions. If we did not clean our dinner plates, or if we wet our beds, or whispered during the three-hour-long evening prayer session, he would send us to the zoo. There, the keepers, also in turbans, called us beasts and locked us in cages with snakes and rhinos and lions. Tears streaking our cheeks, arms around each other, we trembled in the middle of our pens and whispered, "Sorry," while the prophet's voice thundered, "Bad, bad, bad," over the loudspeaker. That's called finding religion. Playing tennis with Winston Churchill. Some of you may not know who Winston Churchill was. He was a prime minister of Great Britain. And he always wore this long, big coat, big long coat, and this hat, and he would go V for victory. It was during the Second World War. Playing tennis with Winston Churchill. Let's say it was in England. Let's say I was invited to play. But London was foggy and traffic was heavy, so when I got to the courts, the three of them, Churchill, my boyfriend, and a woman with inky black hair, were already slamming the ball back and forth across the net. The men wore white trousers and white V-neck sweaters. The woman, a stranger to me, was alone on her side of the net. She was very good. "Ha ha, ha ha, ha ha," she laughed as she ran for the ball in her tennis dress and ruffled panties. "I'm afraid that's 40 love, gentlemen." She aced a serve, then in the next game, put away two in a row and lobbed one over my boyfriend's head. When they came off the court, Churchill put on a long herringbone coat and his customary hat. At last he took my hand and kissed it and said he regretted I hadn't been able to play. I wanted to tell him about the traffic snarl near Buckingham Palace, but he led me over to court too and pressed me against the fence in an embrace. I was surprised at how short he was. His head came only to my shoulders, which forced me to stoop for our lips to meet. "Winnie," I moaned to be polite. Then he pulled a cigar from his pocket, clamped it between his teeth, and made a V with his fingers. "Ta-ta," he said, "it was lovely, my dear." And he walked out, racket under his arm, through vapors of fog, to his waiting limousine. I'll read one new one from Son of Mad Painter, and then I'll close with another one. They're getting scarier as in the Son of Mad Painter. So this is called In the Time of Adolescence. It is our adolescence, and we are learning to be so clever. We tattoo our bodies and our body hide around corners. We speak a new language. We pull on Halloween masks. We want our parents to believe their dreams of us. We know by heart the ratcheting home movie, the beatific image of baby blowing bubbles, the zoom shot of first tooth. How we were loved then, ferried about in our strollers. We still remember the suck suck of pacifier and bottle, the new birthday crown each year, the wolf's huff and puff over the candle house, all those presents. Now our parents are afraid of what we have become, what crimes we will commit. No, no, we sob, we are still little angels. We pull on mittens and snowsuits. See, we chortle. My boyfriend sits on his sled. I get on too. We are going to slide down the hill together. Stop, our parents shriek. Too late. My boyfriend is a snowman with an icicle penis. I am sitting on his lap with round little eyes of coal. That was called In the Time of Adolescence. I'll finish with this poem called The Fathers. All along the road, fathers are repairing the way. They have been spreading sand in the ruts and holes. Now they stand at the shoulder, leaning on their shovels. They wipe their foreheads with blue bandanas. We are preparing the way for our daughters, they say, even though we want them to come on some other road. I have been traveling west on this road all day and night. The ruts are treacherous, some as deep as ditches, and so are the mounds of black earth plowed up like barricades. I am with my husband, the father of two daughters, one blonde, one brunette. I know other fathers, grandfathers, uncles and cousins who are fathers, teachers and doctors and postmen. I once had a lover, the father of five grown girls, who told me he worried about all his daughters. This is my road home, and I have been reckless, a speeder. Do you blame me? My husband shouts that I must slow down, and I try to let up on the pedal. My own father has been dead for 2 years. I threw his ashes over a river that runs north. Now I have to trust these fathers with their shovels. Trust that they will fill the ruts, that they will be able to break down the barriers in time for all of us. Thank you.